Hello, welcome to the Bright Club Southampton podcast. This is episode 13, and I am your host, Dave Christensen. Welcome back if you've been here before, and thank you for joining us if you haven't been here before. So just a quick bit of background about what Bright Club is. So Bright Club is a comedy night, which is where we have researchers or academics, people like that, performing, telling jokes about what they do. So we make researchers funny. And then we get those researchers back in a room and we chat with them about what they do, about who they are, and about their work, and about anything really. And certainly this episode is an example of how far off kind of expected conversations we might go. So this episode we have Chris Allen interviewing Sadie Jones. So Sadie performed at our most recent show, and is an astrophysicist. And Chris is the sort of person who seems very keen to ask strange questions and try to derail the interview. But Sadie dealt with it very well. Anyway, I don't want to ramble on any longer. So here we go.
Hi.
Hi.
So the first question I was going to ask you, I wanted to try and paraphrase your mother as much as I could.
Yeah, great.
So it was, who in the hell knows what these black holes are up to? And I was hoping maybe you could answer that.
Okay, well, I don't know, really. Which is why there are still lots of people here at the university studying this and trying to figure out. But for my single supermassive black hole that I investigated for my PhD, I know a little bit better what that is doing.
Okay.
But only a small amount.
So what is that doing?
It is acting strangely in the sense that... Okay, so all galaxies have a supermassive black hole in the middle.
Yeah.
And our Milky Way galaxy has a supermassive black hole, which is about 4 million suns in mass. Okay. So that's a given, that all galaxies have a black hole.
Okay.
But why I was studying a certain black hole at the centre of another galaxy, very far away from us, about 30 million light years away, is because it's not acting in the way it should, which means it's an active galaxy. And all that means is that the centre of it is brighter, okay? And the centre of it is bright because there's a lot of stuff swirling around the black hole, which is giving off lots of energy, which we can see with X-ray telescopes, radio telescopes, optical telescopes. And if you have an active galaxy, which is very bright, you normally would see a jet, okay? So you've got stuff swirling around the black hole in a disk, and then if the galaxy is really active, you would see at 90 degrees to the plane that stuff is rotating, you would see a jet of particles kind of squirting out.
Okay.
And the type of galaxy, for my PhD, I was looking at, you would expect it to have a very bright centre, but not have a jet. It's kind of a weird example of an active galaxy.
Okay.
But when I looked at it with a radio telescope, I found evidence of a jet, a very weak jet, anyway.
Okay.
And that was strange. So luckily for me, it was strange enough that I could then do my whole PhD basically on that one black hole.
Okay.
So I've answered the question, what are those black holes doing, that my mother asked, kind of, but only about one single supermassive black hole.
And what might that mean for our black hole?
So for our black hole, it basically, we think that all kind of galaxies, as they evolve, their supermassive black holes also go through an evolution and they have a lifetime, but their lifetime is of the order of millions and millions of years. So for us humans, who live quite a short time, we would never, from our kind of astronomy observations, see a black hole go through like much of its life, if that makes sense. So what we think is that maybe our Milky Way galaxy is at a stage where it isn't active, okay? Mm. So there is potential that all black holes, at some point in their lives, are very active, they have loads of stuff swirling around them, they have a jet, but there's also times of their life where they're quite dormant and quiet. And we think that's what our Milky Way galaxy, nothing much is happening, it's not eating much material, it doesn't look very bright.
Okay.
So, but we don't really know which stage comes first. So okay. if it's active first, well actually that's kind of a lie. We think that in the earliest universe, there was lots of these very active quasars with massive jets and things.
Mm.
So yeah, so perhaps the Milky Way did have one.
Okay.
Hi, so yeah, I'm gonna talk about my astrophysics PhD, which I completed like 5 years ago, but it's still having quite an effect on me. So hopefully it'll be funny. My research was into a single supermassive black hole that is 30 million light years away, and I spent like 10 years, I guess? Still doing it now, trying to figure out why the hell it is so bloody messed up. And in doing so, I've made myself a little bit messed up as well.
So, you finished your PhD 5 years ago,
mm-hmm.
And that's when that bit of research finished, is it?
Yeah.
So have you... Not only mean to have a really existential question, but what have you been doing for the last 5 years?
Well, so I only finished that one paper I was just talking about a year ago.
Okay.
So it was 5 years in the making.
Okay.
The reason is because as soon as I finished my PhD, I got a full time job here, taking Lowell Planetarium into schools.
Oh wow! Okay.
And then I also kind of run stargazing events. Alien challenges for schools.
Okay.
Yeah, so now my job is mainly outreach and public engagement.
Wow.
And that takes up a lot of time. So I did normally have 10% research in my contract.
Okay.
But trying to do 10% of anything is hard.
Difficult. Well, it's like half a day. Is it half a day?
Yeah, I think so. Oh, one day a week, maybe.
So tell me about that. That's interesting. What's the... tell me about the outreach stuff, especially the alien...
Yeah, so in July we do something called the SETI Cipher Challenge, which is kind of fake, well, alien messages that school kids across the UK have to kind of try and crack, basically.
Okay.
And they send us scientific explanations for what they think these messages mean, and also media. So they send us some really cool like recordings, like videos, all sorts of stuff. It's really fun. This year we were a bit controversial, well not controversial, but we decided that the messages would actually be from a future human race that were trying to tell us humans now, in their past, how to not mess up the world. And so it had lots of links to like global warming, sustainability, so that was really fun.
So is that something you think there might be in a different parallel universe, or would it be a parallel universe? I don't know.
Well, in our storyline, they were just humans from the future, and that they were using a wormhole, a bit like in the film Interstellar.
Yeah, yeah.
To kind of send us messages through this wormhole to tell us how not to kind of mess things up. And, but I mean, as far as we know, wormholes can't sustain themselves. So if you actually wanted to send information to me as a future human, the current theory is that the wormhole itself would collapse under its own gravity. So the only thing you'd be able to transmit along it, we think, is well, at the moment, is one photon of light. So you could send one photon of light with one piece of information on it before it would collapse, but it would take a long time. You have to keep reopening the wormhole.
So you couldn't do like Morse code, you could literally just do one?
Yeah, it would be really hard to do.
Okay.
So yeah, I found myself during my PhD in a really quite dark place, which is convenient given I'm an astronomer. But yeah, so even now 5 years on, I still struggle to be kind of proud of being a doctor. So when people bring me up and ask me for my title, I still say Miss. I just feel like someone's gonna kind of, you know, come into my office, take it off me, and say that it was just a load of bullshit. but I guess this is good in one way, because I'm on planes quite a lot. I love to travel. And there's never going to be a situation where someone calls me over and I'm like, yeah, this person looks like they're in terrible shape. They really do need some help. But I don't know if telling them about supermassive black holes is going to really
work. Do you think there would be another life force out there that would want to do that kind of thing?
Well, I certainly think there's life other than humans in the universe, just because of the sheer amount of places for them to live. So you've got like 100 billion stars, 100 billion galaxies. Each star could have like 8 planets.
You can edit this question out, but if there was an opportunity to contact, to make contact with another, this is a bit out there. If there was an opportunity to make contact, do you think we should?
We're sending radio waves out in space, and we have been since the 60s. Mm. So if the aliens have the technology to receive radio waves, they could be watching our early TV shows or listening to early radio shows. Those radio waves go out through the atmosphere into space all the time. So
only early radio, so not the.
As soon as we started, like, using radio to communicate on the Earth, those radio waves kind of, we use the parts of the radio wave that bounce off the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. But there's always going to be stuff that goes off into space as well.
Okay, but they can only watch the basic stuff. They can't watch like Sky Sports or any of the newer kind of stuff that goes over.
No, they totally could if they had the technology to. Some people joke that like they've seen like Hollyoaks or whatever, and now they're not ever going to come and visit us because they.
That particular episode of Emmerdale Farm, they were like, no.
They're like, no, I'm not going to bother. But I actually, well, I don't know, you can edit this out. I had a gift from an ex-boyfriend, which was a message you can send into space, which is a kind of ridiculous concept anyway, because, like I said, we're always sending messages into space. And it's not a message sent to any particular location, but you can request exactly what this message says. But because he was an ex, I didn't really want to send anything myself. So I gave it to some school kids as a gift, as a prize, for their STEM club. And they sent the message, please, aliens, please come and have a cup of tea with us. So if some aliens turn up requesting tea, then it's my ex's fault.
What would your message be? If you could have them from scratch, if you could have one and you knew that someone was going to receive it, but you didn't know who.
I don't know, because you assume they can speak English, so, and I can only speak English. Maybe I'd send a message in Welsh just to really confuse them.
If you were to send some message about our culture, kind of like our music, our films, up to space, to kind of show someone what we're like as a race, what would you send up there?
I'm just thinking about my terrible taste in music, so personally I don't think I would be a good representation of that. But there was a message called the Arecibo message, which was like kind of on, I think it was like a radio message as well, but it was also like printed on a gold disc that was sent on, I think, Voyager, or one of the really early spacecraft. Yeah, and that had like a picture of what humans look like, and then it had a little diagram which showed like the sun, and then all the planets, and then pointing to the Earth to show that these humans were from the Earth. And then it had other information like about DNA and things like that, but on a very simple level, so that if the aliens obviously don't speak English, they could look at this and they'd understand.
I mean, in a way, that kind of sounds both interesting, and it depends which way you look at it, doesn't it? It depends whether you see the aliens as potentially like a nice species or a horrible species.
So if they want to kill us, we've given them the exact location of where we are for them to come and.
Kind of, to me, as a bit of an anti-risk taker, it seems like a bit of a risk.
But hopefully, they've seen the Hollyoaks and they know not to bother.
Not to bother.
Yeah, so I'm Welsh. And the other day, I just met this guy, and I managed to convince him that I'd actually shagged the sheep. And I'm really, really proud of this. Bright red, yeah, I just can't lie, and I'll just admit the truth straight away. I even said, like, you know, it was just perfectly normal, it's something all Welsh people do. And you still believe me. And I'm really, really proud. It's just weird that I'm proud of that, but not my PhD.
The other thing I was going to ask as well is about the sort of the cream eggs around campus.
Yeah.
And how it's still like an early version of Instagram in a way.
Oh yeah.
If you could have like one invention, obviously you've missed out on Instagram now, even though you probably saw it before someone.
Oh,
else.
You see, like me inventing something.
Yeah.
Ooh. Oh, this is a shame because I had an idea for a patent the other day. But the problem is, whenever I have these ideas, I Google it, and there's like.
Someone done it.
So, for example, this is gonna sound really rude. okay, so. When you have bananas and you want to bring them into work and not get them bruised,
oh, yeah.
I bought this £1 oh, banana holder from, you know, like the cheaper version of IKEA. What's it called? Tiger.
I don't know, that's a cheaper version of IKEA.
But it's a very, it assumes that your banana is always of a certain shape. So if you have a banana that's a bit longer, it won't fit. So I was like, I have got a great idea. You need to invent a banana holder that will like shape to the actual banana you have, but still protect it from being bruised in your handbag or whatever. And I Googled it, and there was about 6 different websites which actually provide this service already. And I didn't buy one because they're really expensive, so I just have to.
And presumably then it's only able to be used on one banana. Or does it change?
No, so the idea is that whatever size banana you have, this banana holder will adapt. So yeah, like I said, my PhD was really hard for me, and in the second year specifically, there was nobody else in the department doing radio astronomy, which is what my PhD was on. So I really didn't have any friends. But the thing that saved me is my one true love, cream eggs. So I would have the cream egg next to my PC, next to my keyboard, and when I achieved something great in the day, like analysed some data and it worked, I was allowed to eat my cream egg. But it was quite a long day. So for lunchtime, for example, I would take my cream egg out with me, out onto campus, take photos of it with the ducks, next to the stream and some like woody trees in the background. And this was back in 2010, so it was way before Instagram was a thing, so I was so ahead of the curve on like taking photos of my food. And then when it came to eating the cream egg, it didn't end there. I'd eat it, and then I'd take the wrapper, and then I'd stick it to the side of my CPU unit. So I had like a nice shrine. And this is all real. And if you don't believe me, you can go on Facebook. I have a whole album from 2010 where you can see all these lovely photos of cream eggs.
So, I mean, obviously it's very cool, black holes. How did you end up getting into this kind of stuff?
So when I was doing my master's in Cardiff University, I needed a project to do for my bachelor's and for the third year, and my supervisor there just kind of said that there was one on black holes, and that was it really. I thought they were pretty interesting because, you know, time travel and all the science fiction, and that was it. And then it's quite a coincidence that the data I used to do my third year project in Cardiff was from a professor here who ended up being my PhD supervisor. So,
okay.
Everyone knows each other in astronomy, I think.
Okay. So what now that your PhD's finished and you're doing lots of outreach, what's next?
Oh, I don't know. Just doing more outreach. I'm doing the Science Show Off Talent Factory in London, so that's exciting. So I'll be going at least once a month up to London to train to be more of a comedian, I guess.
Okay.
So that's cool. And I was just at the Fringe in Edinburgh on the weekend.
Okay, what were you doing there?
And that was mad. I was part of the Agony Uncles Uncles, which is a mix between aunts and uncles.
Okay.
I'm learning as well. Of science. So we were like a panel of real scientists answering people's like agony questions about their lives with science and trying to be funny. So that was fun. So probably just more of that for me for now.
Okay.
and I'm going to Japan on a conference next year, which is fun.
Okay.
Communicating Astronomy with the Public is a conference that happens. So 2 years ago I got to go to South America. It's always in really cool locations, which is great. And then next year it's in Japan, so yeah.
So that brings us nicely on to what kind of made you decide to do Bright Club?
I was convinced to do Bright Club when I was doing the Researchers Cafe, which is another kind of outreach thing where you talk about your research a bit like this right now, but with members of the public in a cafe. And the Bright Club organiser, Dave, asked me...
That dashing chap.
He was there, and I just had a very sugary brownie and a white chocolate, hot chocolate, both very sugary, so I was very excitable and enthusiastic, and he asked me to do Bright Club, and I said yes. But the good thing about this was I was so high on sugar that I went home that night and actually wrote my whole set before I was able to go to sleep.
And how long before the Bright Club was that?
I think I was meant to do the Bright Club in June, but then there was a cancellation, so I ended up doing it in May.
Did you enjoy it?
Yeah, I loved it, yeah.
What did you feel you got from it?
It was a lot more fun than I was expecting, I think. And I wasn't as scared as I thought I'd be. Okay. I guess I got from it a desire to do more.
The other thing that saved me is the physics building itself. So because it's an astronomy and physics building, it has telescopes on the roof. So when I was feeling quite low late at night and really kind of not having a clue why the hell I was doing this investigation into a black hole that was being really weird, I'd go up onto the roof, I'd go into the observatory, I'd move the telescope, I'd sit down, and then I'd cry.
The other thing I was quite interested in, you said that you, when it's getting particularly hard, your PhD, you went up to the observatory.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been at the university, I've been in and around here for like 10 years, and I've always wanted to go up there, but I've never actually gone up there, because you can go up there, can't you, as a...
So yeah, as an astronomer, we have access to the roof.
Okay.
And because I'm the outreach leader in astronomy, I now actually have a key to the telescopes, which is great. But kind of as a lowly PhD student, you are allowed to just kind of go up there and use the telescopes when you wish, or if you have permission from the master's students, use them for their projects. So okay. It's quite impressive, actually. They've managed to look at exoplanets, so yeah. Planets going in front of other stars, and you wouldn't think they'd necessarily be able to see get that level of detail from here in Southampton because of all light pollution and stuff.
Okay.
But they do some pretty interesting projects. They've done some stuff on supernova stars, exploded okay. stars, using those telescopes as well. But for me, mainly during my PhD, I didn't use the telescopes themselves. I just used the roof as a kind of thinking space.
Okay.
Or crying space.
Okay. Okay.
There's some really nice views as well. You can see like the power station.
Oh, well, Forley power
yeah,
station.
Yeah,
okay.
You can probably see the Isle of Wight. It's a nice clear day.
Sure.
So it's a pretty good view from up there. And maybe
not
I'll show
the telescope.
You later. No, just like from the roof, just of the campus and stuff.
So it's interesting what you say, because we've come kind of almost full circle from the pollution. Because you're talking to the kids about future humankind warning us about kind of
mm-hmm.
global warming, and then you said obviously Southampton's a really, really
so I was meaning
place.
Light pollution just like from the city. So it's not like the kind of pollution that is really bad for you.
Okay.
But Southampton, you're right, does have terrible pollution levels.
So it's not that the pollution's so bad that you can't see through like the smog, it's just the light.
No, I mean that doesn't help. But I think in Southampton the visibility isn't bad necessarily because of the smog. It's more to do with there's just a lot of lights. So if you go out into like the New Forest or I think the South Downs, the Isle of Wight, they all have what we call dark sky status. So this means that if it's a clear night, at least, and it's not cloudy, you should be able to see the Milky Way from those locations without a telescope or anything.
Wow, with the human eye?
Yeah, just with the human eye. Wow. So it's really cool. Like, people think you can't see these things from the UK, but you can. And, like, certainly back in my home in the valleys in South Wales, you can just see the Milky Way from your back garden because you're far away from the city.
So, I mean, I don't know how much telescopes and stuff cost up there.
Again, probably shouldn't say this because someone will come and steal them. But they're about £4,000. But they're very heavy, and
that's
I think they're tied down. So okay. And I think someone would notice.
I thought there'd be a couple more zeros at the end of it. But that's still interesting. That the human eye in a unpolluted area has better clarity than thousands of pounds worth of equipment.
Well, no. I mean, if you had the equipment with you in that location, you would see.
Yeah.
Way, way more.
Okay. So the human eye is not as powerful as a 4,000.
No, but I think people just forget that, like, you can really do some really nice astronomy. Mm. You can sort of be an astronomer without any equipment.
So it could be much more accessible.
Yeah, I think people just, like, we're so engrossed in our, like, phones and looking down that we forget to look up. Like, we go into schools and we tell people how to find north, and they'll tell. We've had stories from teachers where the kids will tell their friends, like, the next day, or they'll tell their mother and father that night, and literally it's like the first time they've looked up in the sky, and I find that bizarre, but it might just be because they've always lived in the city and they're not usually used to seeing anything.
How can that be changed?
Well, I think just getting kids to go out of the city more at night, like, you know, with irresponsible adults, not just sending them out. So there's an ancient eye test in, so if you know the Orion constellation, the story is that Orion, most people know Orion's belt, these three stars in a row you can see in the winter. Orion is a hunter hunting Taurus the bull, and on the back of Taurus there's these stars called the Pleiades, or the Seven Sisters, and they were actually used as like an ancient eye test. If you could see those seven stars, so you weren't told there were seven stars, you were asked, how many stars can you see, young man or woman? And if they could see seven, they had really good vision. So then they could become a hunter or something.
So is that like a really primitive version of the test that when you go to the optician and they get you to read the letters?
Yeah.
That's like a primitive version.
But I mean, I think we take for granted that we, you know, you could see that the Pleiades, just, you could see it all the time. Now you can probably barely see Taurus at all.
So,
but you can see it if you go to the forest or somewhere else that isn't Southampton.
So could you, with your knowledge of the stars and when they're where they are and what time of the year is and stuff you should be seeing them, could you use that knowledge to navigate?
Yeah, well, so we use, anyone can find the North Star. In the Northern Hemisphere, you can always find the North Star because it's directly above the North Pole. And the reason why it's called the North Star is because it doesn't change. So it's directly above the axis of rotation of the Earth. So what that means is that you should always be able to see the North Pole in the Northern Hemisphere, and therefore always use it for navigation.
So you can always find north as long as you can find the North Star.
So the rest of the stars kind of seem to rotate due to the rotation of the Earth. They're not really rotating, we are rotating. But if you're trying to, you know, orientate yourself, that could be a problem. You go around in a big circle. But if you use the Big Dipper to find the North Star and draw a straight line down from it to the horizon, that direction is north. And my brother's in the Marines, and they taught him that just in case his landing craft sat nav breaks. But it only works if it's not cloudy.
Okay.
Otherwise, you'll just have to, you know, I don't know, figure it out.
Okay.
I would bring my mother, because she is the most amazing, supportive, inspirational Welsh person, very, very crazy, but yeah, she said some great things to me on the roof, and they were so great that they ended up as the quotes in my PhD thesis. So everyone, or all my friends at least, have used the same template where you have the chapter headings, you have a quote from a famous scientist. So most people would quote Einstein, but, you know, saw Einstein, I quoted my mother four times. One of my favourite quotes from her was during my third year, when the shit was really starting to hit the fan, and so I was analysing my supermassive black hole in both radio and X-ray, okay? The only thing you need to really realise is that when I did that, I got a positive relationship, okay? And then a few months later, someone basically has looked at the galaxy, done the exact same thing, and got a negative correlation. So I was like, oh shit. I have imposter syndrome, so obviously I was wrong. I started freaking out, obviously had a bit of a cry on the roof. And then I went to my supervisor and he was like, no way, Sadie, we are the ones that are right. We're going to write a diss paper, we're going to take these guys down. So I was still really stressed because I'm really too nice, I think, and I didn't want this other PhD student to be, you know, thinking she was wrong. I preferred myself to be wrong. So I went up to the roof, of course, to talk to my mum. And I said, Mum, I think my paper has started a war. She said, Sadie, you just let them to get on with their warmongering. Who knows what them bloody black holes are doing? And then she said, on a more serious note, don't forget to watch Corrie tonight, because people are going to get killed by a tram.
The other thing I was going to ask alongside that is because you had what I've put in here is black hole wars, in terms of there was someone else who kind of did similar research and found an opposite finding, and then you had to counteract.
Ah, right.
And in my head, I just have this picture of like a West End Broadway of like these kind of astrophysicists lining up in different outfits and sort of.
I wish it was that exciting. I don't actually know if she. I know she's a she from her name. Yeah, so basically I was looking at the radio light from the jet and the X-ray light from the disk around the black hole. And if the disk and the jet are in a relationship, you would basically expect the light curve, so just the light, if you trace the light over time coming from those two parts, the disk and the jet, if they kind of get brighter and dimmer, if you like, at the same kind of time period, then there's some kind of relationship, which kind of means like material would go into the disk and then somehow travel up the jet. And that is kind of interesting because it means there's a link between disk and jet.
Okay.
So that is interesting. But when I examined my data on this galaxy, I found that there wasn't really a correlation, although the data wasn't good enough to say there was a relationship. But when this other PhD student at another university did pretty much exactly the same thing as me, obviously doing her own radio analysis, etc., she found a very strong anti-correlation. So basically saying that the X-ray and radio were doing the opposite thing. And then this kind of linked in with some other papers that were talking about anti-correlations in very small black holes.
So there
was a war in that, in the sense that we both had very different results for the same black hole. But I'm not sure if like she was aware of my stuff and I was, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I didn't really want to stir it up, but my supervisor did. He wanted to have a full out war.
Yeah, so that quote ended up in my thesis. It wasn't just phone calls from my mother, it was also text messages. So on her daily commute from my house in the South Wales Valley, she would go into to Cardiff, and she'd text me every morning some inspirational words. But she also created a whole universe, right? So in this universe, I am an astro warrior, and I wield something called the astrobiological sword. And then I would use this sword to kind of defend myself or vanquish my PhD or the galaxy or the black hole, depending on her mood or my mood. And she even gave me a really cool name, and that was She of the Astrobiological Sword. I don't know why astrobiology, I don't have anything with astrobiology. But it's fine. But obviously in text messages, that's quite a long title. So she shortened it to SOTABS, so she simply called me SOTABS. And then obviously she would sign off with MOSOTABS, Mother.
So in terms of, we talked a bit about Interstellar earlier.
Oh yeah.
In terms of black holes. What's the most, from what we know, what's the most realistic film depiction
Well, so the Interstellar has the most scientifically accurate black hole. So they actually, the graphic designers actually worked with Kip Thorne, who is like a theoretical astrophysicist who like came up with lots of theories about black holes, about them like rotating and what shape they would be. So that black hole, Gargantua, is like actually what it would look like. So I think Christopher Nolan, the director, had a bit of artistic leeway, I guess. He made the black hole look a lot brighter and a lot more symmetrical. So in real life, because black holes spin, the one side of Gargantua would be blue, because it'd be moving away from you, and the other side would be red, and the whole thing would look a bit darker. So they added in some flair to make it look a bit more kind of cool to the people watching in the cinema.
But what about the end where there's like people at the walls and stuff?
Yeah, so so I think everything in Interstellar is pretty much like fine scientifically. I guess even the bit in the walls is fine because it's like another dimension. And we're assuming by that point there's these people that can manipulate gravity. Mm. So if they can do that, then why not have, you know, him in the walls of a bookcase? It's fine.
I just think we don't have any bookcases in here.
I think for me it was just such a long film. By the time it got to that point, I was just, my brain was like, even, you know, understanding black holes, it was a lot for my brain to take in by that point. But The Martian is a very well done film in terms of science as well, and gravity. They're like, all these new films are really, you know, the science of them, like the in Gravity, the way things hit and like all that kind of thing is actually incredibly accurate.
Do you think that might make it more accessible and bring more people into it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I went to see Gravity with my mother and she absolutely loved it. And, you know, like Hidden Figures, which is one of the new films about rocket science. Again, I saw that with my mother and she's like really interested in rocket science and things like that now, so.
So yeah, so I finally finished my thesis. It took 4 years. I only funded for 3, so that was interesting. I gave it to my supervisor and first thing he said to me was, Sadie, are you really going to leave those quotes in from your mother? And I was really pleased because at least you read 4 pages of it.
When we talked about your outreach work where you feel a lot of children are looking down rather than up. And what can be done about that? And you said about maybe taking children outside into the country.
Yeah.
Is there any plans for like that kind of outreach where you could do like a and like an astrology weekend for children in the country?
Astrology? No, astronomy.
Oh, astronomy. Maybe ask that question again.
Astrology, Chris, is where you predict people's futures using the stars.
Okay. Astronomy.
I mean, I wish I could do that. I wish I could predict my own future.
I mean, is there any plans to do that kind of road trip to the country with children so they can see into the sky?
So we went to a Young Carers Festival, which was out in like a YMCA nearby somewhere. So there's more of those kind of festively things for young people cropping up. So obviously they're out camping anyway, listening to music. I mean, we go to Glastonbury with the roadshow. And we have like a science tent anyway. So I think there isn't any plans necessarily for me to take any children into fields or whatever. But I think because there's more festivals just generally happening, there's going to be more astronomers like myself there anyway. So we'll, you know, just by that, we'll be stood there pointing up because that's the kind of thing we're interested in.
So I've got to my Viva. And you kind of sat down with an internal and external examiner, and I managed to get through the Viva. And my internal examiner stands up, shakes my hand, says, "Well done, say you're a doctor." First thing he says to me is the astrobiological sword really a thing? And I said, yes, because my mother did actually go to kind of the local shop. She found a kid's lightsaber that was purple, because it's my favorite color. It has a skull on it that looked kind of sinister, so she kind of fashioned it with some ribbons, stuck some stars on it, and she basically gave it to me, I think in about my second year, and she told me to swish it like in reality, whenever I was feeling a bit, you know, down in the dumps. And I would have bought it tonight because I do still have it in my house, but it is run out of battery because it turns out real life is actually really hard as well. So
in Finland, if you'd got a PhD in Finland, they would have awarded you for getting a PhD a top hat and a sword.
Yeah, so I heard about this the other day on Twitter, and I have a Finnish friend, and I tweeted it to her, and she said that basically that is an option, but you have to pay a hell of a lot of money to have the sword. So I don't think that many people do it these days. And the sword my mother got me, the astrobiological sword, was a very cheap kind of lightsaber, possibly only cost a few pounds, so I prefer my sword.
I just figured if there's any more wars, then you'd be equipped.
So the sword wasn't actually for the war.
So that was my internal examiner. And then my external examiner, who's from Wales, so obviously I knew him before. He stood up, shook my hand, and was like, I'd really like to meet your mother. She sounds like a really interesting woman. So I was like, oh, once again, what's my mother? So I got, that was my viva, and that was in November, so I had to wait a whole, 8 months till July when I could graduate. And my mother was really kind of annoyed at this because she wanted to put the picture on the wall of the graduation and be super proud, but she'd have to wait too long. But she didn't let us stop her because she's a very determined astro warrior. She set off to our little town in South Wales Valleys. She managed to find some shop that could take a picture of a dragon with a lady on wielding a sword, and then she, and I've got it right here, photoshopped my head onto it.
How do you say thank you and goodbye in Welsh?
Diolch yn fawr, nosta.
Diolch yn fawr, nosta.
Diolch yn fawr is thank you very much, and nosta is like good night.
Diolch yn fawr, nosta. Thank you, Tony.
Thank you, bye.
Bye. That was an awkward little.
Hi again. Thank you for listening all the way through. I hope you enjoyed yourself as much as I enjoyed listening to them during the recording. And I hope my laughing in the middle wasn't too annoying. And of course, thank you to Sadie and Chris for their time. And I look forward to recording the next interview with Sadie with whoever she gets to talk to. One more thing I want to say about the recording of this episode was it was great after recording. So we recorded this in the physics and astronomy building at the University of Southampton. And then afterwards, Sadie took us up to the telescopes. So we had a little bit of a look up there, and we saw the view across to Forley Power Station, which I'm sure you're all dying to see. So I will post that online somewhere. So you can see my photo from up on the roof there. While you're online checking out stuff that we're posting, you should like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter and subscribe to this podcast if you're not already a subscriber. And yeah, get in touch, send us an email. It's brightclubsotten@gmail.com. We're in the process of putting together our next show, which is going to be on the 22nd of September. So that's a month. Just less than a month now when you're listening to this. And we've still got one slot free, so if you think you want to perform or you know someone who you think would be good performing, then get in touch with us. Push your friend to do it. It is fun. We've got some more training coming up that helps performers find comedy in their material. That's going to be in a couple of weeks' time. And we give quite a lot of help and guidance and advice and feedback on material to help our researchers put together a really funny set, and we've got a great audience. You know that because you are our audience. You guys come along and you laugh lots, so everyone has a good time, and it is well worth doing. So yeah, please get in touch if you want to perform, and if you don't want to perform, fair enough, that's fine, but look forward to the show. It's going to be a good one. We've got good people for it so far, and yeah, tickets will be available soon, I guess. I don't know exactly yet, but soon. Keep an eye out for it. Yeah, that's all I've got to say for now. So, I'll love you and leave you. and hopefully hear from you soon, see you soon. Stay well, look after yourself. Bye-bye.